The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
You can now support this podcast by becoming a premium member. Head over to the website contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H, and sign up for the bargain basement price of $8 per month. This price will be increasing starting November 1st, so be sure to sign up. There are a number of benefits to premium members, too many to list in this space. One of them is you don't have to listen to these annoying announcements. So head over to contrarian.supercast.tech and sign up. Now, here's today's podcast. Enjoy. Christian Putz of ARR Investments, thank you so much for joining me on the Contrarian Investor Podcast. I wanted to have you on because you have a hedge fund. You're based in London, though you hail from Austria, but we'll get into your background a little later. But you have this fund, and you've been able to navigate what has been a very, very choppy year. And you do this because you have a two-pronged approach to investing, and if I understood this correctly. And the first one is a top-down approach of economies, markets, supply lines, and things like that. And then the other is on individual stocks, you drill down to find these investing opportunities. So maybe you can just start by telling us a little bit about your approach, and then I'd be curious exactly about what your top-down view is right now as we record this on, what day is today? Thursday, October 8th.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Maybe a little bit about my background so people understand better where I'm coming from, right? We manage a global long-short equity strategy and, we have a lot of Europe exposure, US, Asia. But before I started AR Investment Partners, I was working for a company in Russia for an American hedge fund, and I was managing there mostly an Eastern European long-short equity fund. And my experience there, the Russian market from 2011 until beginning of 2016 was in a bear market because on one hand, the oil price came down a lot. Secondly, obviously, there were the sanctions and so on. So my experience is really a lot of bear market experience on one hand. And secondly, a lot of people say in the developed world, like Warren Buffett, you don't have to follow the macroeconomics, just focus on single stocks, right? And, macroeconomics, et cetera, is a lot of waste of time, right? Given my experience, right, in Russia, I see things a bit different, right? Understandably, obviously, if you're an U.S. investor, you only invest in U.S., U.S. is stable, right? I mean, despite everything in comparison to what I went through in Russia, sometimes it might seem that things are very volatile, but the reality is, I mean, for example, what I experienced in Russia is there things can be really volatile. Like I had, for example, in 2014, on one day, the ruble fell by 30% in one day. The Russian market was down 20%. So, I mean, over those many years that I worked there, right, I mean, I've seen like seven times the market fell more than 20% within two months. And on top of it,
I hope that's not Russia calling. Go on.
So in this market environment, right, obviously, if you do only single stock picks, right, and you have a lot of conviction, it doesn't really help you, right? Because, for example, in 2014, right, when you have those events like sanctions, right, even if you're very convinced of a company, right, the market is just crashing, and you, if you don't have the right risk management approach, right, and you're not willing to cut your, you know, positions, etc., you know, you will incur massive losses, right? So for that reason, the strategy I came up with is really I want to, you know, deliver good returns, attractive returns, meaning our goal is to have more than 10%, right? But with relatively low volatility, meaning, you know, a peak to trough drawdown that we want to achieve is less than 10%. And the only way I see how you can do it is that you, on one hand, you look really at top-down at risks that happen globally, right? That if you're just focused, bottom-up, you cannot see, right? If you're a bottom-up guy, you will not see those risks like, COVID, et cetera, right? But on the other hand as well, you know, if you want to make good returns, you definitely have to look as well at bottom-up stories, because they obviously the big advantage is that, you know, you might be wrong on your top-down approach, right? And those bottom-up stories often are quite uncorrelated. So the way we run our book is, you know, we have our top-down approach where it's mostly about risk management, where we want to avoid, you know, big sell-offs. And on top of it, you know, we run a, you know, long-short book, where on one hand we have high conviction long positions, and then as well short positions. And for that reason, our approach, you know, works in a way that there are times really when you can make really big bets on the, you know, on the exposure side, because, you know, and when I talk about big bets for most people, you know, that doesn't mean that we go above 100%, but, you know, normally, like since inception, our net exposure was less than 50%, right? And what I mean is then, okay, we can be 100% invested, right, for example, right? That is for us a big bet, right, where we say, okay, we are fully invested. Or, for example, in March this year, when we had this good performance, we were net short about 15%, because obviously we were quite bearish, and, you know, we had quite some long positions, but as well, you know, many short positions in the, you know, hospitality sector, you know, then hotels and so on, right? Metals and mining sector. So there are times when you really, when it makes sense to have those strong, you know, views on the macro environment, and there are times when it's extremely difficult and it's not clear, right? And in those times, we just focus on really single stocks where we think then, okay, we add value there. Mm. Often, you know, we don't have a strong view, right? And I would say currently it's one of those moments where, you know, it is extremely difficult, you know, to decide, okay, to make a big, strong macro bet, right? In fact, that's not what we want to do, right? We don't want to bet on those binary events where then, you know, you're either right or wrong, but we always try then to find, you know, industries or sectors where we think, even if we're wrong with our macro view, right, we still make money, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how I see currently the situation. So currently, you know, obviously we see some, you know, our opportunities we see are mostly on the single stock level. Mm. On the macro level, we are quite cautious. And okay. So I mean, we run about, you know, 50% exposure, and but all obviously, right. You know.
But it sounds like you're saying that the macro picture is a little more benign, at least than it was at other points of this year. Is that a fair statement, you think?
I mean, I'm honestly, I mean, obviously, it's definitely, it has massively improved, right, since April, right? And I think the interesting thing is, I mean, obviously, a lot of people were surprised how well it recovered, right? And, you know, obviously in hindsight we always are smarter, but I don't want to complicate it. I think and most people know that anyway, right? It's a combination of probably three things, right? The first is obviously the cheap money, right? I mean, the liquidity is just abundant, and when you look at certain charts there, I mean, it's just off the charts, right? I mean, it's just incredible, right? The other thing is then really when you look at the, what in very simple terms, what moves the market, right, is obviously the earnings and then the discount, right? So in terms of liquidity, right? And there you see as well, I mean, at least there were a lot of surprises on the earnings side, and the earnings expectations, we really see this V-shaped recovery, right? So there have been quite some surprises, right? And the third effect is then obviously the surprises, right? And when you look, for example, at the economic surprise index from Citi, et cetera, then, I mean, that's as well off the charts, right? First, this massive disappointment, and then this massive bounce back. So if you want to keep it simple, then one has to say, okay, those three things, if you keep that in mind, then you understand quite well what's going on, right? So we still have a lot of liquidity. The earnings are still going up. And the earnings, or the surprises, the economic surprises, I mean, we're now coming back from those extreme levels, right? They are definitely, it's now getting unclearer. And obviously, that's the factor that is potentially causing, negative surprises, right? Because we might have, more COVID cases and lockdowns, right? And on top of it, we have the election in the US, and it's all a bit unclear what will happen.
Right? Yeah, I was going to say, one of the factors is a certain president and his certain tweets that can and have upended markets pretty significantly. And you just now mentioned the election. Is that not something that you're particularly concerned about in the U.S., not to make everything a U.S. focus here, but as far as, events and things like that, it doesn't sound like that's something you're particularly worried about at this time.
Not at the moment, right? I think it, when we come closer to the election date, then that might be, that might change, but not at the moment, no. Mm-hmm. It's still a month ago there. And what I really see, and I'm surprised myself, right, because obviously, we always are quite cautious, right? And I'm just surprised how strong the market is, right? And for that reason, there are those underlying drivers, that you should not ignore. And I think, I know there are some certain people that have strong views always. We are always a bit more cautious, right? If the market is extremely strong, doesn't matter in which direction, right? That just tells us, okay, there might be a factor we're not understanding, etc. Mm-hmm. For that reason, we are cautious. And currently, we definitely see the market is still very strong, right? Mm-hmm. For that reason, the obvious explanation is simply, this money printing is so strong as an underlying trend, right?
Right,
that
right.
It's far more important than anything else, right?
Fair enough. Is there anything, though, that you see that might indicate that this, economic expansion is getting long in the tooth at all, or that it could be about to kind of be upended? Because these things often happen with very little warning, at least when you're going through them. But then in retrospect, there are oftentimes some things that that do point to there being a little more risk than is perhaps priced in. So is there anything there that you've spotted in your screens and in your signals that you're looking at that could indicate this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously what we, focus very much on is, those obviously, for example, volatility, right, the high yield market, the banking sector, and then all those cyclical industries. And, from my experience in, at my former employer, right, those cyclical indicators often, or sectors, right, like oil and gas, metals and mining, banks, right, often they, tell you, okay, there are problems brewing, right? And surprisingly, right, a lot of those sectors currently are still quite strong. And I would even say, for example, the metal, like the oil sector, right? There might be even a buying opportunity brewing. For that reason, you know, I'm not that negative, right? Because I see, okay, for example, in the oil and gas industry, right? We had this massive rebound in the oil price. And oil prices are relatively stable. And at the same time, the oil sector sold off quite significantly, both in the US and in Europe. And, you know, many stocks since the highs, let's say in June or May, right? Probably June, right? They decreased by 20-30%, whereas in fact the oil price did sell, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this divergence, right? And for that reason, many companies, I mean, they had, you know, for understandable reasons, right? They're extremely cheap. But I would say before corrections, often that looks different, right? And for that reason, you know, if things are more or less stable, then yeah, those cyclical sectors might in fact perform quite well. Mm. It's same, I'm honestly as well surprised, but the metals and mining sector is doing quite well. And the banks as well, right? What we recently saw is that, in fact, the long end, the yield curve is steepening, right? Mm. And obviously, based on that, you know, obviously a lot of people worry about, you know, inflation and, you know, the quantitative easing that's going on down the road. But still, I mean, the risk there, I would say, is more to the upside in the sense that, you know, the yield curve is steepening a bit further, and then banks, you know, might as well rally, I think. And normally, you know, before corrections, things look different, right? And, you know, obviously, that might change in a month, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, if there's a dramatic event. But the way I see the market currently, I'm not that sure, but I'm not that worried now about this big correction. Yeah. I focus currently more on the single stocks where I think, okay, there's good upside or you know, there's downside. And
And reality, I'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, the single stocks. But just one last question on when it comes to the, you know, this economic recovery. A lot of the demand for commodities, I think, it comes from China. I would suspect maybe also the residential sector in the U.S., at least when it comes to copper, is helping things there. But further, like, you know, industrial metals, it does, I believe, stem from Chinese demand. And is there a lot there that you're seeing? Is that something that you track? And is that something that you stay on top of?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, China, for the metals and mining space, is the most crucial, right? Because 50% of the demand is from China still, right? Obviously, there's this EV theme where a lot of people say, you know, the e-cars, etc., will increase the demand for, you know, copper, etc., dramatically over the coming years. And it will be, right? But, you know, I think it's more like this is a story at the current stage, right, that sells well. Because if you look at reality currently, I mean, the part of, you know, consumption in e-cars, etc., is very small, right? I think it's less than, you know, 5% or 3%, something like that. So a very small part. Obviously, over time, it will grow, but, you know, the most important part is still China, right? Mm. I think it's more of a story that sells well, where people say, okay, you know, e-cars are important, and for that reason, copper demand will increase a lot. Yeah, at the current stage, I think it will gain in importance over time, but currently, what's going on in China is far more important. Obviously, we had this massive rebound in the copper price, right? And, you know, that's one thing I thought as well, it's a bit overdone. Because we are now, in terms of copper prices, right, we had levels that, you know, in 2017-18, right, when, you know, Trump got elected, we had those tax cuts. I mean, there was boom everywhere. The PMIs made all-time highs. And at that time, you know, before the trade conflict, I mean, everything was extremely bullish, right? So we had prices like at that time, right? And obviously, one can always find an explanation, right? That, you know, there's supply constraints, etc. But still, you know, to me, it seems like that's quite overdone, right? And there is obviously then a bear market case where one can say, okay, after the election in the US, right, if there is this trade war worsening, etc., right, and for that reason, economic growth globally and in China is decreasing, one can easily make a bear market case for copper, right? So, I mean, that's something definitely that we have, that we are watching, because that is definitely a potential risk, right? But currently as well, I'm honestly as well quite surprised how strong it is still, you know. That's, and obviously understandably, right, the Chinese economy is doing surprisingly well, right? So they had this, I don't, obviously can always question the Chinese numbers of COVID cases, but I mean, they recovered really well and very fast. And so, I mean, you know, but you know, as the experience shows, right, always when you have this massive, you know, euphoria boom, obviously afterwards there are some negative surprises, and then leads to those corrections, right? In 2017, probably most people never expected then that this was the peak in copper, and then, you know, copper prices, etc., would decrease quite a lot in 2018, right, in the beginning of Yeah. So, I mean, that's how the markets really work, right?
Yep.
You know, it's all about probabilities, and there are always some events that happened and that no one expects. And you, at the end of the day, you can just focus on investments that have a good risk return. And some of them obviously will not go well, and some will do well, but on average, you then make money, right?
Right. Okay, Christian Putz, I want to take a short break and come back. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not have to hear the short break, so don't go anywhere and don't hit fast forward. If you want to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's T-E-C-H.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/Contrarian Podcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Welcome back. I'm here with Christian Putz of ARR Investments. You touched on it earlier that you did a stint in Russia, and I mentioned at the outset that you hail from Austria, I believe from Salzburg, if I'm not mistaken, also the birthplace of Mozart. Yeah, so talk to me about how you came to, and this is the segment of the show where we ask the guests about their background, how they came to investing, and what happened for them to arrive at their current place. So yeah, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. In my case, I think it's quite unusual in the sense that, you know, I'm from relatively modest upbringing. So my, you know, I'm from outside Salzburg. My father worked as a bus driver. My mom is a housewife, right? So it's not like many other people that, you know, have, let's say, a banker as a father, etc. And then at the age of 17, in fact, or at the age of 16, besides school, I attended a course on investing. That was like, you know, you could join for free. And at that time, I really started to, you know, get fascinated by the stock market. So at the age of 17, then I started to invest my, you know, all my savings I had. At that time, it was about, you know, 5,000 euros, which I saved. You know, I started in 1997. As you probably remember, right, there was this internet boom in Europe, in US. And I made my second investment was in Qualcomm. And within 2 years then I made on my investments, I made about 1,500%. So at the age of 19, I was a shilling millionaire. And in US dollar terms, that's about $80,000 in today's terms, about $100,000 probably, right? So, that's how it really started, right? And I think it's, I was obviously, it's great when you make so much money early on, right? Because you obviously get fully motivated. And especially with my background, you realize that, you can achieve a lot, right, by putting in the necessary effort. And then obviously, I started working for Man Group in Switzerland. Man Group is one of the biggest hedge funds globally, listed on the stock market. And there I worked in different departments, among others, the fund of hedge fund industry, and as well a credit division that managed CDOs. And so it was a really great experience there because I had many different, I got to know many different aspects of the finance industry, right? And I think that's very helpful. I mean, even, in my heart, I'm a passionate equity investor, but I think it's crucial to understand how the credit markets work because especially at times of stress, right, it's the more about the return of the money than on the money. And, in crisis, etc. I mean, it's really crucial to know what's going on in the credit markets. I was working at Man, obviously, then in 2009-08, there was the financial crisis. The department I was working got, heavily reduced. I think we were about 25 people, 20 people, I think, got, well, at the end of the day, fired, right? I was one of them. And I then decided, I was always interested in Russia, despite the fact that I don't have any Russian relatives or ancestors there. But I always wanted to learn Russian. And so I relatively spontaneously decided to go to Russia. Didn't know anyone there, didn't speak the language. And I arrived there, was learning the language, and then I was simply looking for a job there, and landed a job at Casimir Partners, which was founded by an American who, set up the first hedge fund in Russia, right? And they had, a massive success, obviously, because the Russian market from 2002 till 2007, I think, was up 40% a year, given that the oil price increased so much. And, at that time, you still had the boom years in Russia. So I landed a job there, became relatively fast a portfolio manager. And then everything really changed because from 2011 onwards, the Russian market was in a bear market, right? So, from 2000, as I mentioned before, now, I experienced 7 times the market crashed by more than 20% within 2 months. In total, from 2011 till 2016, the Russian market crashed by, 75%, right? And, down, up, down, up. I mean, obviously, it was very, painful, but a very good experience in the sense that I really learned to make money on the short side. And learned how to preserve capital, which I think is really crucial. And, maybe obviously as well, quite humble. During those years, then I started to manage money for a friend of mine, my first investor, who is quite wealthy. And we had quite good returns, despite the fact that, I mostly at that time invested in Russia. And then in 2015, we started to invest globally because we just realized, you cannot really invest only in Russia because you have the sanctions and so on, and there are many unpredictable events. So from 2015, we invested globally. And, in 2015, we made 51%. And then I left Casimir Partners to set up my own business. And, first I was based in Moscow, and then in 2018, I really moved then to the UK, set up the business here, got FCA regulated, and then built a team in the last years. And you know, we have grown quite significantly. Mm. And as I said, our strategy, I think what sets us apart really from most other fund managers or investment boutiques is this experience I had in Russia, where it was all about capital preservation and then making money on the short side. So, you know, obviously this year in March, we made, more than 18%. And, we're not those kind of perma bearers, right? I know a lot of people, they're always bearish. They're always, you know, then that's not us, right? I mean, we're still, up this year. Not only, I mean, before fees, you know, we are now up more than 27%. And, it's wrong just to be always cautious. I mean, there are times when you really have to take significant risks. And you see as well in the last years, right, that in those sell-offs we have done quite well. And I think the other thing that I realized that is really crucial is, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to build a business that is really long-term sustainable, you need an approach that is more automated and, you quantify a lot of things. So we build our own internal portfolio risk management system where it's all about then, you know, breaking down the investment process in small little steps and then, you know, optimizing those steps, right? I think it's like in profi sport where you really say, okay, you know, you try to optimize every little step. And then, that's the best way to get better over time, right? So, and obviously, if there are certain steps that, you know, we can automate, we also do that. And, for example, one thing we do is where we automate it is screening, where we have a database of more than 3,000 names, like liquid names, and we have some, you know, both on the long side and on the short side, we have some predefined signals or let's say patterns, right, that we're looking for both on a from a fundamental and technical point of view. And then every day we get an email that tells us, okay, those stocks meet the long and those stocks meet the short criteria. And then obviously what we do is from a fundamental point of view, right, we look into those companies and really want to understand whether, you know, the reasons why one should buy a company or short the company are, you know, not just short term, but really sustainable long term.
So how's the book allocated right about now in terms of long and short exposure?
I mean, we have currently mostly long exposure, and it's quite diverse. So meaning, I mean, there's not one big bet. I mean, we have, several tech investments where we think, okay, they offer good value. Then we have certain investments, in the gold space. Then, it's really sectors where we think, okay, independently what happens now in the election, those stocks will do well. I mean, one part that where we also have quite some investments is in the utility space, for example, there as well in the renewable energy space, solar energy, because simply there's so much money being poured into the area, right? So we have, certain tech companies where we think there's some great value, certain utility companies, gold companies where we think there's a lot of values. So relatively, and obviously as well as some farm companies where we think there's great opportunity, right?
Pharma or farmland?
Pharmaceuticals.
I mean, some of the utilities, especially, is a more of a defensive sector. Are you investing for for income, for yield, or do you see value there too?
Yeah, I mean, here we bought some European utilities. Like, in fact, we bought an ETF so to get broad exposure there. Because what we see in Europe is really many of the utility companies. Obviously, they are quite defensive. But what is changing now is that a lot of them are investing in renewable energy, right?
Right.
And so on one hand, you have this defensive aspect, and on the other hand, this growth potential, right? Hmm. And for that reason, I mean, obviously, certain companies have done better there than others, but, you know, you can see it quite broadly that, I mean, this sector has done quite well and is not very volatile, right? So for that reason, we think it's quite interesting, right? Because it's relatively stable, and at the same time, you have this, you know, fantasy that can you give quite some good, attractive performance.
Yeah, the interesting. And then, but you're not quite, you're not into the oil and gas or have done anything there, because you mentioned there that there could be some value.
I mean, currently, I mean, the way we obviously, you know, we look on the way it works is on the long side and on the short side, we look for both, I mean, two patterns, one can say. Like on the long side, it's really, you know, this rebound situations and momentum situations. And on the short side is bubbles and structural losers. That's now independently of our top-down approach where we think really, okay, it's risk on or off, and we might, you know, take a view on the general market, right? So on the rebound side, there potentially we see in the oil and gas sector opportunities because, you know, there are many companies, as I said, that have been sold off very strongly, right? And obviously, due to the ESG, et cetera, right? A lot of people look at the energy sector very negatively. You have many investors that sell oil and gas stocks, not because they think they're bad investments, but because obviously for ESG reasons, right? And so this might offer some opportunity, especially because you're also in the energy space, right? You have certain companies that want to move into renewable energy. When you look at Total, for example, in France, a lot of those companies, in fact, they say, okay, we know sooner or later, you know, or the future is definitely not in the oil industry. So what they are doing is they invest in renewable energy, right? And for that reason, there might be some opportunity, but it's more like we are watching the sector and you're waiting still for the right opportunities. Yes, they're right. It's not that currently we have any of those. In fact, often in the past, we made quite some money by shorting oil and gas companies. But currently, for that reason as well, I'm not that negative. We see a lot of the bad stuff has been priced in. And there might be some, you know, there might be you really then a rebound in this sector. We're waiting for the right opportunity there. And for the right, then really we're analyzing quite some stocks there. So if we have high conviction then on a company, then, you know, we build a big position. But we are not there yet, so.
How do you go about picking stocks in the renewable sector? I mean, you mentioned the utilities that have some exposure to this. Would you not necessarily buy a renewable stock itself? Because some of those, you know, the valuations are pretty exorbitant. And, you know, there's a lot of things with you know, solar and if it's efficient and, you know, can't function without government spending, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you go about investing in that sector?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are a relatively small team, right? And obviously the renewable space, you know, I mean, we knew it is really interesting, right? Because obviously there's so much money being poured into the area. And but we didn't have the expertise, right? We're building expertise, but we are quite small, right? But then we decided, okay, we looked at different companies. And given that we thought, okay, we are not the best experts there, right? In you know, in deciding, okay, we should buy this or that stock. We decided, okay, we simply buy the ETF, right?
I see.
And it's, we bought both in Europe. I mean, we have on one hand, you know, European utility ETF, and on top of it, you know, we have the US solar ETF, the TAN, right? Here as well, obviously, we looked at companies, right? And as you said, some of them have extremely high valuations, right? And then we just decided, okay, you know, I mean, it makes more sense for us to say, okay, we focus here really on the idea, the bigger one, and it's then all about managing the risk. If we had really conviction in one name, then obviously we would buy it. But, you know, our experiences as well, right? In the past, obviously, we would often buy single stocks if you want to get exposure to a theme. But then we as well realized, we did our analysis of our trades, we realized that, you know, if you want to get exposure to a theme, in the past, we might, you know, buy 10 different stocks, right, and say, hey, we think, for example, you know, financials is interesting, etc. And when we did the analysis, then we found out, you know, often two or three stocks did really much better, but many of the stocks performed worse, right? And I think always as an asset manager, right, or there's this expectation that you're the expert on everything, right? And you know, this is a great company and this. But the reality is, I think it's extremely difficult then to, you know, to be the expert on everything, right? And for that reason, we just decided, you know, it's better to say then, okay, we are not the expert on this, all of those companies. Where we really have high conviction, when then we buy the single stocks. And otherwise, if it's just about getting exposure to a sector, then we buy the ETF. So we think it's a far better strategy to say, okay, instead of buying, you know, 10 stocks to get exposure to a sector, like the, you know, renewable energy sector, we just buy the ETF, and then maybe we buy one, two stocks where we have a lot of conviction. And I think on one hand, it's better for performance, right? Because you have more conviction then, and you know, you focus on the conviction. And secondly, what we really care about is risk management, right? The reality is as well, in terms of executing, right, and you know, reducing risk, it's much easier to say, okay, we have been wrong, we sell one ETF, than to sell 10 stocks. And for that reason, we also decided, in both in terms of performance and as well in terms of risk management, in terms of manageability of the portfolio, it is far better to have, you know, ETFs and single stocks, right? Some people might say, okay, then you're not the experts and you should know better. But, you know, we look at the facts here and we just realized, okay, we know our strength. Our strength is not always that we are the, we know 10 stocks really well, but our strength is in terms of risk management and, you know, maybe one, two stocks we know well.
Very good. Very interesting. Christian Putz, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. In closing, maybe do you want to tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, websites, Twitter accounts and such? And I will put this in the show notes as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, our website is arrinvestments.com. And obviously, you can find me as well on LinkedIn, Christian Putz. You're not on Twitter, but, you know,
No, it's fine. Yeah, Twitter's the only social media I find at all useful. I guess maybe LinkedIn a bit. Anyway, cool. That's good to hear. All right, wonderful. So yeah, arrinvestments.com. And thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.